please rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has only one cause on its oral submission schedule due to settlements, and that matter is in the matter of Leslie Haslett-Thacker, a disciplinary appeal. The court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument, and the appellant may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal of the court. These arguments are being recorded by the court for its convenience. If you desire to listen to a tape of the argument, you may make application with our clerk. The court is now ready to hear argument from appellant.
May it please the court, Mr. Chris Flood will present argument to appellant. Appellant has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, your honors, my name is Chris Flood. I'm here for Mr. Dick DeGaren, who's the attorney for Ms. Thacker. To give you a brief background of why we're here, Ms. Thacker, who's also present, was charged with the offense of purchase of a child pursuant to Section 2511 of the Texas Penal Code. She went to trial, was convicted, sentenced to a term of probation, and placed her conviction on appeal. Shortly thereafter, the state bar filed a compulsory discipline procedure against her petition, wherein they alleged that she was convicted of an intentional crime, and a hearing was conducted before the Board of Disciplinary Appeals. At that time, I represented Ms. Thacker before the board and argued to the board that while there's really no contest to the issue of whether or not the offense was committed intentionally, the real issue before the board was whether or not the offense was an intentional crime as defined by the rules. Specifically, the point of contention is whether or not the Section 2511 of the Texas Penal Code, which is entitled Sale or Purchase of a Child, is a crime involving moral turpitude. I have in my brief cited for the court what I believe to be the appropriate precedent regarding whether or not sale or purchase of a child is in fact a crime involving moral turpitude. More recently, this court has issued an opinion, I think on March 30th of this year, in the matter of Lloyd Humphreys, where this court addressed even more fully the issue of moral turpitude and whether or not a crime is moral turpitude on its face, that is a per se violation, or whether or not a crime is involving moral turpitude after looking more into the nature of the offense. The point on appeal for Ms. Thacker is twofold. One, whether or not sale or purchase of a child is in fact per se moral turpitude. And two, if it is not, then should the Board of Disciplinary Appeals inquire further into the facts and circumstances of the underlying offense to determine whether or not her actions would affect her moral fitness to continue in the practice of law. Now, a brief factual background. Ms. Thacker has been practicing law since, I believe, 1966, long before there was licensed child adoption agencies. Soon after she started practicing law, she went into this child placement agency type of practice. Since 1984 or 1986, I'm not quite sure when the Department of Human Services enacted policies regarding child placement agencies, she has been in constant contact with them regarding her policies of paying expectant birth mothers reasonable living expenses or reasonable medical expenses during the term of their pregnancy to ensure not only a uncomplicated delivery, but also a healthy child that then will be placed for adoption. I believe that what has happened in this case is that there is an overlap of some sense between the Department of Human Services regulations that Ms. Thacker was relying on, and in fact had been in contact with the Department of Human Services, and the Texas Penal Code. The Texas Penal Code negates the payment, or actually negates a payment of reasonable medical expenses as being an offense of sale or purchase of a child. And just for purposes of that, I'd like to state that the Penal Code says if you give something of value to an expectant birth mother to place her child up for adoption, that is a criminal offense, unless that payment was for reasonable medical expenses. The Department of Human Services goes one step further and says specifically that cash payments to birth parents to cover costs of food, household supplies, personal hygiene, and grooming products, and even gasoline or public transportation are accepted payments by a child placement agency to an expectant birth mother. So what we had in this, in Ms. Thacker's criminal case was where her defense was she had made these payments to these birth mothers, she never denied making these payments, that she'd always made these payments, that she had been in contact with the Department of Human Services regarding these payments, but that the court instructed the jury only on the exceptions that are included in the statute and not the exceptions that are included in the Department of Human Services policies. Now, the reason why I give that background...
Counsel, so that's the reason you say there's no question of what she committed the offense?
I believe there's no question that she made payment to expectant birth mothers that had placed their children up for adoption through her agency. I believe there's also no question that she did it thinking that she was doing it correctly or that it was fully within the law. There was never any issue at the trial that she'd avoided or denied making.
Suggestion that she was out there running a gray market operation?
I'm sorry, a gray market operation?
Yeah, that's what they used to call it.
Well, Your Honor, yes, that she was running a child placement agency in accordance with DHS regulations, but not necessarily in accordance with the Penal Code.
Well, what I'm suggesting is at the time that this provision of the Penal Code was enacted, there was a big flurry publicly about gray market placement of children by attorneys in private practice, working with doctors and buying and selling babies and what have you. I never saw any evidence that it was existed, but there was a fear of it. So this was enacted basically to put child placement in institutionalized situations. Precisely the Gladney home was the biggest advocate of it, I think. But you say the evidence shows that she was working in coordination based on the information given to her. She was in communication with the Department of Human Services. She wasn't out there running around back alley.
No, operating a gray market operation, no, Your Honor. The evidence is that she had been in contact with the Department of Human Services regulations since it was her business and since
they were aware of her.
That's correct, Your Honor. And since it was her business and she'd been a lawyer for 30-something years, she knew how important it was to make these payments in accordance with the regulations. As a matter of fact, she never used to make the payments. The evidence was that she never made the payments for living expenses, only for medical expenses, until DHS, Department of Human Services, changed their regulations in 1984 or 86. I'm not quite sure the year. At that time, she felt, according to the Department of Human Services regulations, that she was authorized to make such payments. And the whole reason why I give this factual background is because I believe the Board of Discipline Appeals should have inquired further into the nature of the facts underlying the crime. Because Section 25.11 is not on its face a per se offense involving moral turpitude, then the analysis that this court engaged in State Bar of Texas versus Heard at 603 Southwest 2nd 829, wherein this court stated that we must look to the nature of the offense.
What if she had done what she'd done without checking DHS regulations?
Then that may affect her moral fitness to continue in the practice of law.
Why, if it was for the same good motive?
Well,
she just didn't check. It happened to be parallel, but she just didn't check.
Well, if she had just not checked and not done anything dishonest or in an attempt to circumvent existing law, then I would argue that she should also be given at least a chance to present that evidence before the Board of Disciplinary Appeals. But in this situation, she not only checked, but had been given somewhat of a green light by the Department of Human Services. And that those facts should have been brought before the Board of Disciplinary Appeals. And I attempted to argue those facts and was prepared to present those facts.
But weren't those facts presented to the jury?
The facts were presented to the jury. However, the charge of the court's charge to the jury merely negated the exceptions in the penal code and did not allow the jury to consider the Department of Human Services regulations. There was a requested jury charge by Mr. Guerin, which was denied by the court, which included not only medical expenses that the code allows for, but also reasonable living expenses that the Department of Human Services allows for.
So that's the basis of your appeal?
That's one of the basis for the appeal. It's the sufficiency of the evidence, the failure to charge the jury properly, as well as other.
Let's assume that you presented that evidence to the jury and the charge on the guilt or innocence didn't go with what you wanted to be charged the jury. A person in Ms. Thacker's position, isn't a $10,000 fine and 10 years probation still a pretty stiff sentence? I mean, should the Board of Disciplinary Appeals be able to consider the sentence that was imposed by the jury?
Well,
in kind of analyzing the...
I don't believe the extent of the sentence should assist the court in making a determination of whether or not a crime is a serious crime as defined by the rules and whether or not it involves moral turpitude. Some crimes involving moral turpitude, if an individual, the individual offender, is especially in a favorable position before the jury, they could get probation for something very egregious, which would involve moral turpitude. But simply the fact that the jury found her eligible for probation and awarded her probation has no bearing on whether or not the offense involves moral turpitude.
But if you're arguing to that the Board of Disciplinary Appeals should consider mitigating circumstances in evaluating whether or not this is, you're saying this is not a per se violation, the board needs to look at mitigating circumstances. Would the board then not be in a position of evaluating whether or not the jury considered the mitigating circumstances and based on the sentence the jury rejecting?
Well, the jury did not consider, actually they were not instructed to consider Ms. Thacker's defense of relying on Department of Human Services regulations.
Yeah, well, my question said, well, that went to guilt or innocence. The question I was talking about was the sentencing. She went to the jury on sentencing.
That's correct. That's correct. If the court was to consider that, they should consider it in conjunction with the fact that she had a co-defendant who went to trial with her who had numerous prior convictions for other offenses. And I say a co-defendant, it's the woman, the expectant birth mother, was also charged in the offense for receiving the money from Ms. Thacker's agency. And she, as it turns out, had numerous prior problems with the law, and therefore maybe the jury felt that they were being somewhat lenient in giving that term of probation, because I believe Ms. De Jesus actually received a lengthy jail sentence. So I don't know that this court could assume anything from the fact that the probated sentence was 10 years. I don't know that that necessarily would mean that they were particularly outraged by the conduct of Ms. Thacker. As a matter of fact, you can almost infer to the contrary that the fact that they probated the sentence would be some indication that, since they didn't have to probate the sentence, that would be some indication that they were not offended by it.
Mr. Flint, how can the Board of Disciplinary Appeals look behind convictions without, in effect, retrying the case and perhaps impeaching the jury's determination in the criminal case?
Well, maybe a review of the record. I wouldn't be asking the Board of Disciplinary Appeals to attempt to impeach the verdict. But because a crime is not per se involving moral turpitude, the Board of Disciplinary Appeals would have to look beyond just the judgment itself and to the nature of the offense and how it was committed in order to determine whether or not that attorney, we're talking about someone's livelihood for the last 30 years, whether or not that person's moral fitness to continue in the practice of law is appropriate.
So you're not asking to present additional evidence at the Board of Disciplinary Appeals hearing? You would be satisfied with the board reviewing the trial record in a criminal
Certainly.
Case?
Certainly. I think that would be sufficient, because then the nature of the offense that this court spoke to and heard would be considered.
But if the trial court had excluded the evidence on the grounds that it was irrelevant, you would want to present that evidence to both?
I think it would be appropriate for the Board of Disciplinary Appeals in that case. In this case, the court did not exclude such evidence, just merely pulled the rug out from under it at the end of the trial and not charging the jury on the defensive theory that was presented during the case.
Is that case appeal? It is currently
on appeal, pending before the 14th Court of Appeals, there will be a briefs that have been submitted, and I believe it's set for oral argument. I can't tell the court what day. So what Ms. Thacker is asking is that this court find that the Section 25.11 violation not be considered moral turpitude per se, and that it should be remanded to the board for further determination.
Any other questions? Thank you, Judge.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from Appellate.
Next, please, the court. Ms. Linda Acevedo will present argument from Appellate.
May it please the court. As Mr. Flood has correctly pointed out, the only genuine issue in this case is whether the criminal offense of purchase of a child is a crime involving moral turpitude. It's our position that it is, and that BODA correctly concluded as such. The most recent Humphreys opinion issued by the court reiterates that the issue to be is a question of law, that it is to be considered by the nature of the offense as it bears upon the lawyer's moral fitness to practice law, and that generally it involves crimes or is implicated by crimes that involve dishonesty, fraud, deceit, misrepresentation, deliberate violence, or that reflect adversely on a lawyer's honesty, trustworthiness, or fitness as a lawyer in other respects. Although it's not mentioned in the Humphreys case, it's our position that the Muniz case out of the Corpus Christi Appeals is still relevant, in that the Muniz case also says that you need to consider the fact that the crime was committed by a lawyer as opposed to a layperson, that a lawyer is held to a higher standard because of the public trust in which she enjoys. Given this, it's our position that the crime of selling and buying babies definitely fits within the Humphreys definition. This is a crime which is motivated.
Is there any indication that she was buying and selling babies?
Purchase of a child, I guess that would be the buying of the baby.
Is she buying these babies? How much is she paying for them?
It's not clear from the record that was before BODA.
Is it clear in the record in the criminal case? That was before BODA, I assume.
No, it was not. The criminal,
They don't even look at the record?
No, sir. The record of the criminal court was not before BODA. No, sir.
So how can you suggest it's a crime involving moral turpitude, if indeed, and is it disputed that she relied on the DHS regulations, that she was in communication with DHS, that they were aware of how she was operating?
In two respects. One, if you take the Humphreys opinion in which you look at the nature of the offense, what is this crime about, why was the legislation enacted, and what it was to do was to curb or eliminate what you referred to earlier as gray market selling or purchasing of children.
Well, it's questionable whether that was a real reason, but go ahead.
And, yeah, that's right. Now, with respect to the DHS regulations and going into the facts of the case, there isn't any indication from the record that she was not able to argue this before BODA. They did make the argument that she relied upon the regulations, that she went to DHS, and DHS said, yes, this is fine. However, I do disagree with the argument that the jury was not given the opportunity to consider this affirmative defense. They may have not been given the particular charge that Thacker had proposed. However, if you look at the charge that was submitted to the jury, and I believe it is in the record, was in the record before BODA, that affirmative defense was submitted. The affirmative defense that was submitted to the jury says, if you believe that this defendant has shown by preponderance of the evidence that she reasonably believed that her conduct did not constitute a crime and that she relied upon the agency's interpretation of the law, then you're to find her not guilty. That's in the charge that was submitted to the jury, and they rejected that. So what I think was really going on before BODA was an attempt to try to have BODA reconsider an affirmative defense that had been considered by the jury and rejected.
Under Rule 8.02, entitled a piece of evidence, it says that the record or a conviction order of deferred adjudication is conclusive evidence of the attorney's guilt. But I think Justice Enoch asked about whether BODA ought to be able to consider the sentence that's been given and whether the sentence is any indication that the jury was persuaded that there were some facts in mitigation that would, while it would lead them to convict, but would lead them to sentence the defendant on more leniently than it would in more aggravated circumstances. Can BODA take that into account?
Justice Cornyn, it's always been our position that BODA can take into account mitigating circumstances with respect to imposing discipline. For example, in this particular case, Ms. Thacker was given a fully probated sentence. Therefore, BODA has the discretion either to simply suspend Ms. Thacker or to disbar her. So in that sense, I believe that BODA has the ability to consider whatever mitigating circumstances are involved in determining discipline. And until the court's opinion last Wednesday, obviously it would have been our position that you could not go into the facts and circumstances of the case in determining whether a crime involves moral turpitude or not. That you simply look at the nature of the offense and how it bears upon the lawyer's fitness to practice law. And I believe the Humphreys opinion also talks about that the compulsory discipline for intentional crime turns solely on the validity of the record of conviction, the nature of the sentence, so it does include the nature of the sentence, and the only factual determination being, is this the same person who was adjudicated guilty in the criminal offense? I would like to point out to the court that if this court is of the opinion that this crime is not one which involves moral turpitude per se, the Humphreys opinion suggests that a remand to BODA would be in order to determine that it provides both BODA and potential parties who are appearing before BODA with the parameters that such inquiry is going to require. I mean, clearly I don't think anybody would argue that it would entail a reconsideration of guilt or innocence, but it's important to know what guidelines will be considered, whether it will be restricted to the indictment, to the charge in the case, maybe possibly harm to the victim, to the plea agreement that was entered into. Something that would give both the board and parties what parameters are going to be considered. How far are you going to allow individuals to delve into the facts and circumstances of the case?
There appears to be a disagreement here between you and counsel for the appellant as to what was charged the jury in the criminal trial. I understood counsel to argue that the defense of following DHS regulations was not submitted to the jury, and I understand you to argue that it was. Is counsel just wrong, or what is the reconciliation of that disagreement?
Well, I tell you, if you look at the charge, and I'm not really sure what page of the charge it is. It's on page 23 of the brief that I submitted in the appendix. And again, it's not clear to me whether simply the proposed charge by Thacker was not submitted. Maybe that's what occurred. But it appears to me that if you read, it's sort of in the middle of the page, it occurs to me, it seems to me that there was an affirmative defense that was submitted saying that if she reasonably believed that her conduct didn't constitute a crime and that she acted in reasonable reliance upon an official statement of the law contained in a written order or grant of permission by an administrative agency charged with the law, and goes on and on, then you will find the defendant not guilty. And so to me, it appears to me that that was the defense about relying upon. She didn't think she was committing the crime. She relied upon the DHS regulations, and they told her it was okay, that it's in here. And if they had believed that, this was an affirmative defense, if they had believed that, they would have found her not guilty. This court is well aware that the compulsory discipline scheme The foundation of it rests upon the judgment of conviction itself. There has to be some confidence and some trust in the criminal justice system that has a higher burden of proof that affords defendants more constitutional protection. And that's the only concern we have about going into the facts and circumstances of the case, is that there is a danger of sort of diluting that and maybe going back and either retrying certain issues, submitting new defenses or something like that. And the appropriate place for this to occur is in the criminal justice system. If Ms. Thacker's conviction is ultimately reversed, then everything goes away for us. I mean, we are bound by the judgment one way or the other. And that's what I want to impress upon the court with respect to this particular case and other cases that are going to come before the court when the court doesn't believe that it fits within the per se category.
Was there, did Ms. Thacker have a written order from the agency? Did she have a written order from DHS?
What I remember from the record before BODA was that she had submitted her, or this was the argument that Mr. Flood made, that she had submitted her particular process or procedure to them. I don't remember if he said that somebody actually testified, that they had told her that that was okay, and in fact, it seems to me that she did have something in writing, but I'm not absolutely clear. I'm just going by what is in the record before BODA. And again, I believe Justice Heck had asked a question about if you consider the statement of facts in the criminal trial, then there may be questions that will be raised with respect to evidence that was either admitted or disallowed over objection. It may not matter that much if the conviction is final, because you take it as you get it, but if it's on appeal, there may be some issues with respect to that. And it may be that until the conviction is ultimately decided, you take the statement of facts as you get it from the criminal trial. These are simply issues that I want to lay out to the court as far as providing guidelines for future cases of this kind.
Going back to whether or not this offense is an offense of moral turpitude, is it my understanding that if an agency pays living expenses in addition to medical expenses, that that's an element of the offense?
I believe that what the statute provides is that you're not to give anything of value for possession of the child in order to put him up for adoption, and then it provides some exceptions. And one of them is, if I recall correctly, a fee placed with the child placing agency. Another one has to do with fees paid to lawyers. Another, and the one I think you're talking about is there's an exception for both legal and medical expenses. And I suspect that what's going on here is the interpretation of what that includes.
Well, that does not include living expenses. And I'm not clear, can an adoption agency provide living expenses to an expectant mother?
I don't know the answer to that.
The State Bar filed a motion to dismiss this case, and the response is that this is Rule 711 allows an appeal from a determination by Board of Disciplinary Appeals. Would you speak to that issue, please?
Certainly, Justice Cornyn. Our position, the truth is, we're not interested in continuing to file these objections to jurisdiction if this court believes that these judgments are appealable or in final order. Our main concern is that a respondent doesn't get two bites at the apple as far as appealing goes. For example, in this particular case, if this court were to affirm the Board of Disciplinary Appeals and the conviction ultimately gets affirmed and it goes back and the judgment of disbarment is entered, we wouldn't want Ms. Thacker to be able to come back and appeal again and either raise the same issue in a different fashion or possibly raise some issue that hasn't been raised before. For example, she's not raised the fact that the board decided to disbar her as opposed to simply suspending her, even though her suspension was completely probated. I wouldn't want to depend, though, upon 7.11, because if you go with the analysis that any determination, then what that opens the door for is if they deny a motion for continuance, if they deny a motion, I mean, any determination they make on any motion, theoretically, then could be appealed to this court before the final determination is made. if this court is going to take a position that it can consider this case and that it has jurisdiction, I think it would be better to base it upon the fact that BOTUS already decided everything they need to decide in this case. In other words, they've already decided that if she gets affirmed, she'll be disbarred. If it gets reversed, then the orders will be terminated. And so in that sense, anything that happens in the future will simply be ministerial in nature. So that would probably be the better approach to take rather than depend on any determination by the board, because then I can think of other things that would come up that this court would probably not want to hear in the middle of the case. And so in conclusion, I would just like to say that we do believe that this is, that the nature of this crime and the way that it bears upon the lawyer's moral fitness to practice law is a crime involving moral turpitude per se, and that the judgment of the Board of Disciplinary Appeals be affirmed. In the event that the court does remand it into some type of limited or some type of factual inquiry, we would request that it be some sort of limited inquiry with respect to how far the board can delve into the facts and circumstances.
Any further questions? Thank you, Congressman.
Mr. Flood, may I ask you the outset? I believe you indicated that the nature of Ms. Thacker's practice is to his private placements.
It was.
And that is her exclusive. Was her exclusive practice?
I believe she also was engaged in other civil litigation. Most of it was oriented to family type practice, I believe.
Should that affect our consideration as to whether this particular crime affects her professional fitness to practice law, given the nature of her practice?
Well, she has been enjoined from, as a condition of her probation at this point, has been enjoined from engaging in that child placement agency. And the Department of Human Services has already revoked her license to practice based on these allegations. So I don't know that there should be consideration given to the fact that is she still out there doing this. I mean, I attempted to argue that before the Board of Disciplinary Appeals, and they did not really want to consider that. By the way, before the Board of Disciplinary Appeals, we attempted to go into the underlying facts and circumstances, and it was never considered. They took the position that they could not consider it. So it's not a situation where they considered the offenses of Ms. Thacker or considered the trial record and have flatly rejected it. They felt that they were not empowered to go beyond the record. Fact that there was a conviction entered in the Board of Disciplinary Appeals proceeding. They felt that they were precluded from going beyond that.
Did you attempt to present the trial record?
I did not have it present. I asked that we be allowed to present it, and they took the position that they could not consider the underlying facts and circumstances. I'd like to just rebut briefly this court's holdings or the allegations by the counsel for the state about the Muniz and Humphreys decisions, because I think if you take the Muniz and Humphreys decisions and apply the facts in this case, this is not a crime involving dishonesty. It's not where Ms. Thacker dishonestly deceived either the adoptive parents or the expectant birth mother. It's not one involving fraud or deceit, misrepresentation, deliberate violence, or anything like that this court spoke to under the ABA model rules in Humphreys. If you look at the factors in Muniz, number one, anything done knowingly contrary to justice, honesty, principle, or good morals. Like I stated earlier, Ms. Thacker thought that what she was doing was authorized. And the jury charge instruction issue is nebulous because the jury charge only negated the exceptions in the statute. And as Justice Spector pointed out, there is a tremendous overlap or lack of overlap in the DHS regulations and the penal code. The penal code exception says reasonable legal or medical expenses are authorized. DHS, however, and I'll be happy to submit post-submission on the DHS regulation states that an agent can make reasonable expenditures on behalf of birth parents including cash payments to cover costs of food, household supplies, personal hygiene, grooming products, gasoline, or public transportation. That's a far cry from just legal or medical expenses. And
that's an official DHS regulation.
That's an official DHS regulation.
Why doesn't that come within either one of the two categories in the charge?
In the penal code?
No. Why doesn't the statement that you just read come within either one of the two categories of the charge?
We requested a finished request of jury instruction number 2 asked that the exception be for reasonable housing costs, food, clothing, utilities, personal hygiene products, and transportation.
The charge accepts any official statement of the law or written interpretation of the law by a public official, in essence. And if that's a DHS regulation, why would that qualify?
We believe it should have qualified under the absolute defense to the charge of sale or purchase of a child. They should have been asked to say, do I have a reasonable doubt as to whether or not these expenses went for these things, and if they did, she's not guilty as a matter of law. Instead, the court compromised and submitted an affirmative defense issue where the burden is still on the defendant to, by preponderance of the evidence, not by raising it and then having the state negate it by beyond a reasonable doubt. Only Ms. Thacker's personal views on whether or not what she thought what she was doing was authorized by a DHS employee or official. So it put the focus more on Ms. Thacker's views and her testimony as opposed to whether or not these payments were in fact made for reasonable housing costs.
Any other questions? Yeah, just one question. I couldn't really tell. How many children did Ms. DeJesus put up for adoption?
There was, I believe, one or two existing children and one unborn child. Not being the trial attorney, it's difficult to know exactly the answer to that question. But
were those all the children in her family? In her?
I don't know that either, Your Honor. I do know that the reason why this came up was existing children had been kind of back and forth between family members. And when she was going to have a third child, she sought out Ms. Thacker and decided to put all the children in a better home rather than in the situation that they were in, which was being tossed back and forth between relatives. It's a situation where the children were taken out of a bad situation and put in an adoptive home, a nice atmosphere.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in this cause, which is submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal will now please adjourn the court.